The UK has been accused of a cover-up during the time that they were involved in the Afghanistan war. A new inquiry launched into how the SAS soldiers killed Afghan civilians dated back to the year 2010. Now, what is worse is that this involves more than 50 summary killings by the SAS soldiers. And even worse yet, it came when for years there were reports that elite British troops killed civilians in cold blood, which meant that they were aware of it, authorities higher up. Why was this covered up is the first question, and more importantly, why would the British soldiers do that? Were there orders from the top down? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce them. Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author and journalist, who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Farhiz, I'll first start with you. So we have the nature of the crime, as it's been said, which is much more extensive than this, but this is an inquiry that's being held again on more than 50, what we understand, summary killings by the SAS soldiers, 54, according to what has been revealed. And it happened in Helmand province between the years 2010 and 11, of which the conclusion was that this amounted to war crimes. What is your immediate reaction to this, something, again, that's been reopened to follow through in order to perhaps get some prosecution, if that is at all possible?
Firstly, I don't think there'll be any prosecutions whatsoever. If you consider that this is already a decade after these war crimes and murders, extrajudicial executions have been carried out, and it's only now that the second investigation is underway. The people in Afghanistan will never receive justice. The only justice they had was at the bayonet points of the British soldiers that had gone halfway around the world to oppress and subdue the Afghan people. As you introduced me, I live in Belfast in Ireland, and we all here know about British war crimes. In 1971, on the 9th of August, when the British reintroduced internment without trial, the British paratroopers run amok in Belfast on the 9th of August 1971 and murdered 11 people in what were called the Spring Hill Ballymurphy massacres. The inquests have only taken part last year, 50 years after those people were brutally cut down. People who were unarmed, including
why does it take so long, though? Why does that take that long for this to be even covered and then, you know, perhaps again, with, as you said, no prosecution to take place?
Well, it's part of the cover-up. You see, if you don't have an inquest, then there's no accountability as to how the people died. The British government and indeed the British Army claimed that these people were armed, that these were terrorists, that these were insurrectionists, people who died in gun battles, which is all lies, and it's all propaganda, and it's all cover-up. And in fact, 6 months after these murders in Belfast, we had 13 unarmed civil rights protesters murdered in Derry on what was called Bloody Sunday on the 30th of January. Right. 1972. And the gentleman who was in charge of that was then later went on to become the general officer commanding of British Land Forces. A soldier one day becomes the general officer commanding several years later after committing war crimes in the streets of Derry.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start out with a general description of a couple of the first, the general, overview, Robert Fantina, of what was disclosed, and then we're going to get into a couple cases, if not three, if we have the time, of the nature of the crimes that were committed, because that needs to be, unfortunately or fortunately, reviewed here, so that you can grasp the gravity of the crime that was committed. First, in terms of the overall view, from the evidence and disclosures required by the court, it says that the Afghan man detained by these SAS soldiers were during night raids, and they were often separated from their families, and they were shot dead. This was routine, where the troops then went and planted weapons on them to justify the crimes. So that's an overall view of what happened. The question is, why would they subscribe, these SAS soldiers, to such a method?
There are a few reasons. One is that they were given orders by their superiors and supervisors to do this, to terrorize the population by killing the men in their, or pulling them out of their homes and killing them. So terrorize the population to subdue them and prevent any kind of resistance to the invading forces could have been ordered by their leaders. The other reason is simply that these soldiers, many soldiers in the United States, UK, and other places, are trained to kill. That is what they do. That is their job. And so they see anybody and they will kill them. They also, there is discrimination against the people of Afghan. Afghanistan is not a Christian country. It's mainly a Muslim country. And in the West, Muslims are seen as different and dangerous, and so the soldiers who are accused of killing, who allegedly killed these civilians, were probably part of or felt that same way, that these people weren't worthy of life the same way as they were, and therefore they were free to kill them. Now, this is what we see in war frequently, so it's nothing new. The fact that it's been exposed or is being investigated after all these years simply tells us that the British government doesn't take it all that seriously.
Well, let's take a look at a more graphic example here. And I'm sorry if it bothers you. I do apologize right now. But Frau Hughes, I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyways, because this is one of the things that is pretty much an eye-opener, where you have an instance of two Afghan children where it is, again, citing this source, at 8 p.m., you have the British and Afghan soldiers. They burst into a home. A 12-year-old boy and a 14-year-old who were staying there overnight were taken, and a witness said, "When I entered the room afterwards, I saw bones and teeth all over the place. There were four altogether. The four of them were lying there, blood everywhere." Is that what SAS soldiers are trained to do?
I think brutality goes along with the mindset of people who are trained, specifically the special air service personnel. They're trained not to take prisoners. They're trained to torture people. They're trained to gather information, and they're trained to terrorize the local population. You don't have to go any further than, was it Abu Ghraib, when you see what happened in the prison there with the torture, with prisoners that were naked, that were attacked by dogs. The dehumanization of other races and other religions and other nations is part and parcel of like Western imperialism. So, the brutality, there'd be nobody held to account. And these people will just basically get away with murder, and the victims and their families will never get any closure. And, let's not forget what's happening in Yemen. Let's not forget what's happening in Syria and in Libya. This is happening all over West Asia and further afield.
Sure.
And the brutality that we've witnessed in Ukraine as well from the fascist lure, it's a mindset, and unfortunately, no one's held the account.
You mentioned a very key phrase there, Robert Frentina, and you said that this may be, or that this is, how orders have been handed from the top down, which is why it's executed by these special soldiers. And I found a sentence where it's interesting, where it said that it's the sort of violence that occurs in a war where brutality is encouraged from the top down. And then it went on to say Britain's whole occupation is built on it. Do you agree with that?
Yes, Britain has a long history as a colonial nation, like over 100 years. And throughout its that colonial history, it's been very violent. Look at what the British in India and other places. So violence is always part of war. It's always part of colonialism and occupation. We can look at what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians and have been for decades now. Violent, oppressive, cruel, really inhumane. And these are the components of war and of occupation. They simply come with the territory, and they are all criminal. They're all crimes against humanity. They're all war crimes. But countries, governments continue to perpetrate them, or perpetuate them, I should say, and we don't see them being held to account in really any circumstances whatsoever.
This not being held to account is what the problem is, which I believe leads to, if you agree, Farah Hughes, to this being committed on a repeated case. I mean, when you take a look at what has been revealed, where the UK was aware for years about these SAS soldiers and they're basically committing war crimes, but criminal investigations were closed without any prosecutions to be brought forward, then that kind of is a green light for them to continue it in any other war scenario or any other scenario. It may not even involve a war scenario. Why would years of reports actually not be investigated, do you think?
Well, I think there's several parts to this, and one of them would be that the British government does not want the British people to know what's being done in their name by their army and by their special air services. And the other one is, we in the north of Ireland have gone through our own kind of post-conflict amnesty. The British government last year actually brought into, or is bringing onto the statute books, a law that would give amnesty to war crimes carried out by British personnel over the 30 years of the conflict here in the north of Ireland. And it's been suggested that the amnesty would be more wide-ranging than the amnesty that was offered by Pinochet to cover human rights violations in Chile when he was in charge. And Queen's University in Belfast and the Committee for the Administration of Justice have both said that this amnesty proposed by the British government on behalf of the British Armed Forces would go much further than another 300 post-conflict amnesties. So what we have is not only no accountability and British soldiers being above the law, but now the law is going to be changed in order to protect them from war crimes. And if I was in Afghanistan, I would actually be bringing cases before the ICC, the International Criminal Court, in The Hague, rather than try and get justice from the British government when none will be forthcoming.
Well, we have a situation here, Robert Frentino, where it's pretty interesting. You have the UK Ministry of Defense that created what was called the and I'm going to move to another war scenario, and it's called the other war that the UK was involved in, which was based on the false premise of supposed weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which that never turned out to be the case. They actually created a ministry called the Iraq, not a ministry, but a team called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, where it looked into accusations of abuse committed by the British in Iraq now, between the years 2003 and 2006. And then they discovered some 280 victims of alleged unlawful killings and 1,235 cases of ill treatment, which included rape and torture. And then you have the government come up with a UK MP's committee, which said, you know what, that's not true, that can't be right. And they said it's an unstoppable self-perpetuating machine, deaf to the concerns of the armed forces, and that it had to be shut down. How do you explain that?
This is only explained by the fact that the UK government, like many or most other governments, doesn't want to be constrained in any way by going to war wherever they choose to go. And as your other commentator mentioned, they want their people to think of the military and members of the military as noble and going around the world to help people. This, of course, is a huge lie and a complete myth. They don't want them to know the savagery that these soldiers commit on a regular basis. Now, the fact that the UK established a committee, identified war crimes, crimes against humanity, and then simply, with a stroke of a pen, voided those findings is beyond appalling. The innocent victims received no closure, no there can be no compensation for loss of life. Nothing will compensate for that. But there's no accountability. And this just leaves the military, it gives the military free rein to commit whatever crimes it wants to in the future. So soldiers know from this that anything they do, they will not be held accountable for, and there's no limit to the cruelty they can inflict on their victims.
So let's take a look at some of the wars, and let's pick the two that really stands out, I think, for Al Hughes, and the one in Afghanistan, obviously, and then, of course, the Iraq War. If you were to take a look at the way that the countries involved and their soldiers, how they acted in such a way, and I'm not talking about all of them, but obviously a portion of them that acted in the way that they did, where obviously violations of human rights was taking place at a minimum based on some of the ruling acts that have taken place, and I'm being very soft on calling it a violation of human rights. Didn't that contribute to the war itself to be lost and for the for there not to be a success, particularly, for example, when we take a look at Afghanistan, 20 years there, and you had UK soldiers, you had soldiers from ISAF, you had U.S. soldiers, but they didn't, as the one general once said, they wanted to win the hearts and minds, and they didn't. I believe it was the former General Flynn. It's because of these types of acts. Wasn't that a contributory to them not winning the war overall?
Yes, they've used violent repression in order to stop resistance. So what they've done is they've invaded against the will of the Afghan and Iraqi people. The people have reacted and resisted this foreign military intervention and occupation. And in order to stop and try to prevent the resistance, then they bring about more repression, more fear, more murders, more torture, more violence. And the more that they use that, the more people react. If you kill someone in cold blood who's innocent and unarmed, their brother, their friend, their son, it's not about revenge. People will just at some point say, this is not acceptable, and in order to stop this, we must make these foreign invaders leave our country. But the fact is that Britain and America and the other people involved in this, they tried hearts and minds here in Ireland as well. It's nothing more than propaganda, giving sweets to children, visiting people in hospital, trying to bring aid and succor and comfort to people in small communities. It's all PR. It's all propaganda. It's all a manipulation of the reality of what's happening on the ground. And, you know, from the day in our, any colonial power goes in and occupies any sovereign nation, there will always be resistance, and that resistance normally always wins. It's just a matter of time, be it 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or in the case of Ireland, 800 years. But eventually, sure, People will fight and receive their freedom.
Indeed. Well, you have instances where, Robert Fintina, you have the accusations and then the proof that is out there, but yet the governments, the respective governments, don't want to follow through with the prosecution. In the case of the UK, since we've put some focus on that, even the ICC Court at The Hague has said hundreds of Iraqis, in terms of their testimonies, showed a pattern of beatings, sleep and sensory deprivation, stress positions, deprivation of food and water, sexual and religious humiliation, and what have you. Kind of sounds like a rap sheet for the American soldiers in Abu Ghraib and what they did there. When this happens and so much time has gone by, doesn't this mean when the prosecutions are not there that there's a flaw in the system and that needs to be rectified? But then who do you go to do that? Because obviously these soldiers or whoever that's committing these war crimes are they're immune to it. They're being shielded by the governments.
It's not a flaw in the system. The system is working the way the governments want it to work. They want to avoid and evade, push out the timeline investigation. Hopefully people forget. Hopefully the stories will, and then they can sweep these atrocities under the rug and commit them again. Now, these new investigation that has launched or is in early next year will be probably another show, some testimony given, some witnesses, and then minor findings maybe maybe determined or decided upon that there were some abuses here and there, but nothing that was typical. And then there might be one or two soldiers getting a slap on the wrist. But the people who are really responsible, the lead, held accountable, and they will be free, commit these crimes against humanity again and again and again, simply because, as I said, this is the way for the governments. They want this free reign to do whatever they choose in whenever they're involved in a foreign invasion, and holding people accountable for their crimes against humanity would constrain them. It's as it should work, but it's not how the governments want it to work, so they have set up the system so that there will be no accountability.
Sure. Well, I can't help but look back as our guest there was talking, Fra Hughes, and get your thoughts on what was called the Chilcot Inquiry, where you had the case of this, as I mentioned before, in terms of the false notion of WMDs in Iraq, and yet you have the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair or the former U.S. President George Bush Jr. who have walked scot-free and they've been responsible for so many deaths. And still the remnants of that war are echoing in the hospital chambers of people who are suffering from nuclear remnants from ammunition that was used, that was tainted with nuclear material. I mean, it's just something not right about this.
Yes, you're probably referring to the massacre in Fallujah where they used depleted uranium. I mean, Tony Blair, he, in my mind, he's a war criminal, and so is Bush. And all the deaths that occurred are all about foreign Western corporations going in and taking oil and gas and gold and whatever else it is that they took. And in Iraq, didn't they take millions, if not billions, of gold, pounds worth and dollars worth of gold bars that were that were in Iraq? And then on top of that, we can see through all this pain that still continues today. I mean, there's still landmines, there are still people losing their legs on a frequent basis in these countries from all the landmines that have been kind of abandoned all over the country in order to inflict further pain and torment kind of post-conflict after the war has been resolved. But there weren't only, you know, victims in Iraq and Afghanistan. You mentioned the Chilcot report, and it made me think straight away of David Kelly. David Kelly was the British scientist who was claimed to have sexed up the dossier in order to make it appear that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which was the excuse used for the war. He walked off out into the woods near his home and didn't come back. They said he committed suicide. But in the film, The Killing of Kelly by George Galloway, there are persistent rumours that he was murdered. So the British government didn't just murder people in Iraq and Afghanistan. They quite possibly murdered a British scientist in order to cover up what he might have told any future inquiry as to how they came about with this whole notion of the weapons of mass destruction as an excuse to invade Iraq.
Sure. Looking down the road here, Robert Fantino, quickly, if you can answer this, are we looking at pretty much the status quo to continue? Based on the fact that you're not getting the prosecutions that these cases deserve for any future endeavors in a war scenario that in particular the U.S. may be involved with or the U.K., because usually they're, you know, work with this special relationship they have hand in hand.
Yes, and most of the wars on the planet do involve the United States in one way or another. And yes, sadly, we are going to see a maintenance of the status quo. There will be some, as I mentioned before, some minor findings from this current investigation, as there were from U.S. investigations about abuses in Iraq. But then the next war will see the same kinds of crimes, same kinds of cover-ups, and the same kinds of pseudo-investigations. When you have the British government investigating its own soldiers or the U.S. government investigating its own soldiers, that is not an impartial judge. There needs to be these things need to go to the ICC so that they can be viewed impartially. Otherwise, we're going to see the same continually.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Robert Fantino, author and journalist. Fra Hughes, thank you so much. Journalist, author, and activist. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoba Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم كذبت عاد المرسلين
عاد denied the messengers
إذ قال لهم أخوهم هود ألا تتقون
When their brother Hud said to them, Will you not fear Allah?
Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, we have reached the 123rd verse of chapter Shu'ara to be discussed. كَذَّبَتْ عَادُنِ الْمُرْسَلِينَ إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ هُودٌ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ إِنِّي لَكُمْ رَسُولٌ أَمِينٌ فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُونَ The 123rd verse says, The odd people belied the messengers, when their brother Hud said to them, Will you not fear Allah? Verily I am unto you a trustworthy messenger. Then be in awe of Allah and obey me. Now, this is the start and the beginning of another section of this chapter. We have mentioned about six different sections. The most important ones were the sections of Prophet Abraham, Prophet Moses, Prophet Noah, and now this section that explains how Prophet Hud exhorts his people to guard themselves against evil, and that he does not ask any recompense for it, and he is only asking the recompense from the Lord of the worlds. Now, كَذَّبَتْ عَادُنِ الْمُرْسَلِينَ The Ad people belied the messengers. Ad, the people of Ad, and the name Ad, was the name of the great-grandfather of the people of Hud, and that group of people were known by the name of their ancestor. Ad people were a tribe from Arabs who were living in the good climate land of Yemen, located in a region near the sea by the name of Ahqaf. Their country was flourishing, it was habitable. Those people used to live in cities and Hud was their prophet, and this is how they continued to live in. Their name has been mentioned in 24 occurrences of the Holy Quran, and in the Quran, there is a surah called Ahqaf and another surah named Hud, which is emphasizing the importance of the story of these people. However, here are the words of the Holy Quran about the people of Ad and their prophet Hud, which is a part of this surah. This part of the chapter entails the life, the destiny, and some instructive lessons involved with these people that has been mentioned in 18 different verses.
(Speaking in Hebrew) We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Now, as was mentioned before, the people of Ad were a tribe who lived in Ahqaf in the area of Hadramaut, a part of Yemen located in the south of Arabia. Those rebellious people rejected the messengers of Allah, and as the Quran says, كَذَّبَتْ عَادُنِ الْمُرْسَلِينَ. The Ad people belied the messengers. Now, next to this short statement, the Holy Quran explains more about them. So, up to now, we know they rejected only Hud, but since Hud's call was the call of all divine prophets, they had in fact rejected all the prophets, because they all invited to monotheism in the first place. Now, next to this statement, the Holy Quran explains more. It says, when their brother Hud said to them, will you not fear Allah? إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ هُود أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. When their brother said to them, will you not fear Allah? As a sympathetic brother, Hud used to kindly invite them to monotheism and piety, and that is why the word أخ or brother has been applied about him in this verse. We also explained more, I assume, about the word akh that was applied for the other prophets mentioned in this very chapter. Then Hud added, verily I am unto you a trustworthy messenger. Inni lakum rasulun amin. Now he wanted to say that the background of his life among them was an evidence for this fact that he had never paved the path of treachery, and he had never got anything but truth and truthfulness. That is why he started invitation of the people with introducing himself as Akh, and then starting to warn them about fear of the Almighty Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website, at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of Truth. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. After the prophets, their committed followers, and the infallible imams, peace be upon them all, strove for the protection of Islam to the point of sacrificing their holy body. Today, it is an obligation for the Iranian nation in particular and the Muslim community in general to protect ardently this divine trust, which has been officially established in Iran and which has already generated an outstanding outcome in such a short time.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and in this program we try to have a profound reading of Imam Khomeini's precious words and speeches. Well, in one of his speeches about ethics and spirituality, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh holds that if our spiritualities and our tendencies towards the Quran are preserved, we will be victorious in the end. Whether we embrace martyrdom, which is a good success, or we become victorious. Well, there are some points about this praiseworthy sentence. First of all, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh is reminding us that spirituality in its nature is good, but it is worthy and precious only when it is accompanied by the teachings of Quran or it is used in religious realm. You know, in fact, such type of spirituality is a direct result of the kind of intellectual development that takes place when a believer ponders over the Creator and his creation. This spirituality source is reflection rather than any sort of mysterious exercise. So when a believer trusts God and works on his or her own spirituality, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh sees victory as the undoubted result.
Ya Rabbana salli ala wa
Welcome back, dear audience. You're listening to Spring of the Truth. We're talking about spirituality and how it is worthy and how it becomes important considering the religious aspect. Well, another point to be raised about this speech is the definition of victory. Unlike what is thought about victory as success in a battle or a war, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, is in fact referring that even martyrdom is one type of victory. We must keep that in mind, that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was the victorious in the Battle of Karbala, although he and his fellows were martyred. We must keep that in mind, that Imam Hussein alayhi salam was the victorious in the Battle of Karbala, though he and his fellows were martyred. It is the high level of spirituality within the spirit of a martyr which makes him or her victorious. Let's just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about ethics and spirituality. Well, in that regard, he said that if our spiritualities and our tendencies towards the Quran are preserved, we will be victorious in the end. Whether we embrace martyrdom, which is a great success, or we become victorious.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The PTI lawmakers did not appear before the Speaker of the National Assembly for the confirmation of their resignations, which they tendered in April following the ouster of former Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence. While responding to a letter written by the top leadership of Khan's party on December 15, the Speaker of the Parliament, Raja Parvez Ashraf, called PTI's MPs to appear one by one in his chamber for the legal exercise under the rules of procedures and conduct of business in the country's National Assembly, terming it as another U-turn of Imran Khan in his political career. The lawmakers belonging to treasury benches criticized the policies of the PTI party chief, saying that agenda of the former prime minister is only to politically destabilize Pakistan.
The Speaker of the National Assembly, through a written letter, asked the PTI lawmakers to come and complete the constitutional requirements for their resignations. But the PTI leadership is using the move as a political stunt. Actually, they are not ready to resign from the parliament.
While defending his party decision, the PTI leadership says that it will approach the country's top court to seek acceptance of their mass resignations instead of the parliament, and will also dissolve the assemblies in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces.
Why we are dissolving our own governed assemblies in two key provinces of the country? Because the country is heading towards destruction under the rule of an imported government. The only way to save the country is to hold free, fair and transparent elections.
Amid political tug-of-war in the country, Pakistan's former PM Imran Khan announced last week that he would go to the parliament on Thursday to confirm the resignations of his party lawmakers and dissolve the Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa assemblies on 23rd of December. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Mm-hmm.
The Taliban officials on Tuesday ordered a nationwide ban on university education for Afghan women. Earlier, a letter made public by the spokesman for the Ministry of Higher Education, Ziaullah Hashimi, outlining that the measure would take effect immediately in private and public universities. Today, the Taliban forces barred women from entering Kabul University.
This piece of news was really disappointing. Last night, when I was told that the Taliban have ordered girls to be excluded from universities, I couldn't eat or sleep. After so many efforts and attending several classes in hope of making a bright future, they at once ruined everything. This order is very painful and unacceptable. It has to be reversed.
This was very shocking. Nowadays, we've been sitting our final test. Today, despite knowing that they won't let us in, I rushed to the university. This is very difficult for an Afghan girl to comprehend the weight of being barred from getting education. So far, I've been worrying for my sisters who are banned from schools, and from now on, I should be concerned about my future too.
Afghan experts warn that the new order will have a devastating impact on the future of women as well as the entire Afghan nation. They urge the Taliban authorities to stop rolling back Afghan women's rights.
It is a catastrophic decision to ban women from universities. This can also be seen as a terrifying shock for Afghan society, especially the youth and women. It is so bitter and concerning. Previously, the explosion hit our girl students in tuition centers, but this devastating order is targeting the progress of a whole nation. The effects and consequences of this illogical order are unfortunate and irreparable in different arenas.
It's difficult to imagine how a country can...
In addition to oppositions from inside Afghanistan, the United Nations and several countries have condemned the order. They have signaled that the Taliban administration won't get recognition until they equally observe the human rights of all Afghans. After taking power, the Taliban promised a softer role and upholding women's rights. But today, many here say that the Taliban have been failing to abide by their promises. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual military spending to $858 billion. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It
Iran's nuclear chief announced this week that the capacity of uranium enrichment in the country is now twice as high as the total volume produced since the onset of the nuclear industry in Iran. He made the remarks in an exhibition showcasing Iran's latest achievements in the nuclear sector.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology.
This is one of the achievements Iran has publicized in recent days, which is viewed as a response to what Tehran describes as the West dilly-dallying on the revival of the 2015 deal. The pact has been in limbo since the U.S. walked out of it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran.
The Americans claim that the Vienna talks are no longer a priority for them amid the unrest in Iran. First of all, they have a role in engineering the riots. Secondly, they do want to resume the negotiations, but they are trying to use the unrest as a bargaining chip in the talks.
In October this year, Iran deployed more advanced centrifuges at its three enrichment facilities, increasing their total number to 4,000. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced this week that it's now enriching uranium at a historic 60% rate using the new advanced centrifuges.
As hopes for the revival of the 2015 deal dwindle, Iran says it reserves its right to boost its nuclear energy program, which it says is clearly stipulated in the accord. The AEOI says it will not wait for the resumption of the Vienna talks and will continue to expand its nuclear activities for peaceful purposes. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Saudi coalition has seized another fuel ship bound for Yemen, keeping it from reaching the port of Hodeidah to unload the much-needed fuel. Military officials based in Sana'a confirmed that they have not ruled out the military option against the Saudi coalition in order to prevent what they call acts of piracy in the Red Sea.
I can confidently say that in the near future or in the days ahead, we will all witness an escalation of military operations, and perhaps we are going to see a one-of-a-kind military operation that will target the vessels in the Red Sea that are pirating Yemeni fuel ships which have received the necessary permits from the United Nations. The Yemeni army could also target the oil industry in both Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I can certainly assure you that the status quo is going to change, as military officials' strategic patience is wearing thin.
According to the spokesperson for the Yemeni petroleum company, Isam al-Mutawakkil, all Yemeni fuel ships are forced to sail on a path crossing near the Saudi Arabian coastal area of Jazan, where an American base is believed to be operating.
All Yemeni fuel ships bound for Yemen have been seized and fallen victim to these acts of piracy near the Saudi coastal area of Jizan, where they are searched under American supervision. This is happening despite the fact that they are already being inspected by Djibouti. Therefore, we should hold accountable the Saudi and American coalition along with the United Nations, which is allowing these acts of piracy that are causing great harm to the Yemeni people.
Yemeni military and political personnel have expressed that a peaceful solution will be impossible if the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate due to a limited supply of fuel and diesel. Tensions are also on the rise in the strategic province of Hodeidah, where coalition forces are reportedly building up.
If there is not going to be a peaceful or political solution, then perhaps the solution is going to come through the barrel of our rifles in order to stop these aggressor nations which are taking orders from their American and Zionist masters.
As 2022 draws to an end, so do all efforts for a peaceful solution. However, as the humanitarian situation continues to grow worse by the day in Yemen, the military option could be the only option left on the table.
The Yemeni government based in the capital Sana'a has proved that it has the military capability to hit long-range targets in land and at sea. However, it is still keen to reach a political solution and end the conflict that has taken the lives of tens of thousands of innocent people. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
About 70 officials and representatives of think tanks and research centers from 36 countries are in Tehran to attend the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022. The initiative, dubbed Neighborhood Policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is the third of its kind, and this time it focuses on regional friendship and trust building.
The main message of this forum is boosting regional cooperation and dialogue. We always welcome dialogue, particularly when it comes to finding solutions to the challenges that we face.
The keynote speakers of the forum, former Iranian Foreign Minister Kamal Kharrazi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq Adel Abdel Mahdi, the Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Ronaldo Moncada, and other participants reiterated the same stance, giving Iran credit for the initiative.
This is important in order to strengthen your policy in the regional dimension due to the new dimension in the whole world and new world order that is much more focused on regionalism than as on the wide international arena.
Pakistan and Iran are the only two countries that are always directly affected by Afghanistan. So I think the Tehran Dialogue Forum is very important in that regard, that there has to be regional dialogue. And Iran being at the forefront of this is a welcoming development. And I think, look, it's important for the region to take ownership. And we see Iran doing that through this forum. And I think it's important, again, to discuss through dialogue to move forward towards any cooperation.
The message of the forum, however, is not limited to regional countries.
We can only really build peace if we do it through dialogue and with the diversity of participation. So I think we are grateful for the invitation to Venezuela, and we think it's important to address this. Even though we're not from the region of Iran, we also think in regional terms. Venezuela is part of Latin America and the Caribbean. We are a zone of peace, as we decreed it in 2014. And we think that it is important for the different regions of the world to establish communication and see how we can really face common challenges.
The first and second rounds of the Tehran Dialogue Forum were held in 2019 and 2020. And as always, addressing the latest developments in West Asia will be on top of the agenda.
The discussions of the Tehran Dialogue Forum 2022 will continue in four different panels, focusing on regional security, energy security, the Ukraine crisis, and the prospects of peace in Afghanistan. Gizumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The first Iranian-made particle accelerator. The high-tech device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light. Developed by Iran's Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute, the Dynamitron-type accelerator was unveiled at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran on Saturday.
We aim to generate 20% of the country's electricity from nuclear energy and the use of radiation technology. We focused on various accelerators and radiation systems, which can serve a wide range of needs in society. It's a technology that improves the health sector and can be used in food security and environmental preservation.
The Iranian accelerator will be used for food irradiation, cable and wire manufacturing, tire industries, sewage treatment, and sterilization of medical devices. The AEOI says the machine will also be employed in treating cancer patients.
The applications of this technology are numerous, but compared to developed countries, we have stepped into the field of particle accelerators about 50 years later. In fact, we have possessed this technology for a long time, but it was limited to research purposes.
Particle accelerators were first invented in the 1960s to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice their byproduct, and that is an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown accelerator, as put by its developers, will transform different industries in Iran. Experts here say for sanctions hit Iran, building such a high-tech device is more than an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings.